Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. Almost everyone I know complains at some point about how tech is running their life, how it's supposed to make life simpler, but it seems more complicated, how tech's supposed to help free up our time, and we're busier than ever, and how it's supposed to provide more convenience, yet here we are more stressed than ever before. Well, Christina Crook is a pioneer and leading voice in the field of digital well-being, and she joins me today to share how simple shifts in the way we think could eliminate that stress, how simple changes can help reconnect us to the real world and give greater meaning to our lives. Christina Crook is the author of the award-winning book, The Joy of Missing Out, Finding Balance in a Wired World. She regularly shares her insights with media platforms, including the New York Times, Harper's Bazaar, and the BBC. And she's joining us today to talk about her new book. It's called Good Burdens, How to Live Joyfully in the Digital Age. And here's my guest, Christina Crook. Christina Crook, welcome to the show. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, my pleasure. And listeners who listen in often know that I have talked about the struggle myself with technology and having to spend so much time on it for work. And I was really glad to find your book, Good Burdens, How to Live Joyfully in the Digital Age. And I know a lot of your work is around this, around intention and mindfulness. But let's look at how you got here with this work. There was a tipping point for you. On your website, you write, it was 2013 and I was feeling this flatness. I'd grown tired of the web mediating my relationships, which of course it does. I felt the internet was making me lazy as a thinker, a writer, and friend. And then I saw a priest blessing a smartphone, and that was the tipping point. So tell us where you were in life and what was going on and why that was the tipping point for you.
Yes, thank you for bringing me back. I haven't thought about the priest blessing a BlackBerry. They don't even exist anymore. A very early smartphone. Where I was in life was I was a young mother. I had very young kids at the time. I had recently moved from Vancouver, so around where you are on the Pacific coast of Toronto, and sort of in one fell swoop, all of my relationships were somehow mediated by technology because I was in a new place, you know, establishing new relationships. And so I was really keyed into the ways in which I was relying on social media, not to engage so much directly with loved ones and friends, but to kind of just like voyeuristically like creep on people, you know, like that's when we started doing that with Facebook, kind of just keeping up with what we saw pictures of, but not really directly connecting. I was also a freelance writer, and so was, because I had such little margin to do creative work, having young kids, I was very aware of giving that precious time away. And so I did end up taking a 31-day fast from the internet. And the tipping point was watching this documentary where there was a scene of a priest blessing a BlackBerry. And I just thought to myself, like, can this thing, can this smartphone, can it be a blessed thing? Can it be a blessing to me and others? And that kind of started me off on this whole journey.
Right. Because, you know, ostensibly, this is supposed to be a tool for us, a tool, but it's almost like we've become the tool for it over the years. I want to talk a little bit about some language that you use in the book, just so that people know what we're talking about here. And the title of the book is Good Burdens. It sounds like an oxymoron, but it's not. According to your book, philosopher Albert Borgman coined that term. So please explain what you mean by good burden.
Mm-hmm. So first of all, Albert Borgman is a professor emeritus from the University of Montana, so a technology philosopher, and he coined this term way back in the 80s, and I came upon it reading one of his books. And he talks about how there are certain activities that once you get across a certain threshold of effort, the burden of them disappears, and how those kinds of activities are actually very important as we push back on, you know, the endless pull of convenience, particularly through our technologies. So he uses the example of gathering around the table, right, for a meal with loved ones. It's a very effortful thing. It's a burden. You have to, you know, plan out the menu and get the groceries and cook the meal, right, and invite people. But once you're gathered around the table enjoying that experience, right, it becomes a joy. But that is the idea of a good burden.
Right, right. It sounds as though he was very influential with your work, because you mention him in the acknowledgments. How did he influence you in other ways?
Yes. So originally through his writing, and then going deeper into not just his books, but into essays and recordings of talks he had given. And then ultimately we met virtually. I had him as a guest on my podcast, the JomoCast, and he was just such a delight. At the end of our conversation, you know, after the recording was stopped, I said to him, I said, Albert, I've noticed you've published a lot of books, but you've never published a book called Good Burdens. And he's 80, at that point, he was 83 years old, and he was like, use it, take it. Like, he didn't skip a beat. He was just like, have it, run with it. He has deeply influenced my thinking and my philosophy of technology. One particular part of his philosophy that is central to my work is, I am a digital well-being expert, but my approach to digital well-being is not limiting technology, which a lot of the conversation around, you know, digital detoxing and all these types of things are centered on that. I am focused on creating the positive conditions for other engagements to thrive and flourish. So what I mean by that is making it as easy as possible to get to the things we want to do or we say we want to do. So making your digital spaces and also your physical home and workspaces as easy as possible to get at what matters.
Right. And I definitely want to look at some of those things that you share in the book, because, you know, some of them I definitely need to adopt myself. I want to just talk about FOMO. Obviously, I mean, I think everybody knows that means the fear of missing out. So you say FOMO's core message is, I'm not doing enough, I don't have enough, I am not enough. It's kind of sad when you look at it that way.
Yeah, FOMO's very sad. It's not a good feeling. You know, FOMO is wanting what other people have, or in more cases than not, what people appear to have, right?
Right.
Especially through social media. And yeah, we're hearing those messages all the time. You know, I should be doing that. I want to be doing that. And all that is speaking to is a lack that we feel in ourselves or in our circumstances. Yeah. And so the reverse of that is the joy of missing out, which is saying, I can be confident in missing out on those things because I love what I've chosen to do with this time. I don't need to have fears about the things I'm missing out on. In fact, I'm missing out all of the time. We're always missing out, right, on every other thing we could have chosen to do.
Right. You know, and when you have that realization, the joy of missing out, and that, you know, you can live with it and deal with it and it's okay, that in itself is very joyful.
Yes.
So let's talk about the experience of joy as you see it. And you say it has two elements, active noticing your attention and active nurturing your effort. So would you talk to us a little bit about those elements?
Mm-hmm. So I've been studying the intersection of technology and joy for more than a decade now. And I'm always looking at different ways to look at the word joy. And I started looking at an actual list. I had asked some people in my community to write to me to tell me the things that brought them most joy. And what I noticed in those was that they all involved in some way attention and effort. So you had to either be attentive to what was happening because you could have missed it, right? You could be sitting on a, you know, on the lakeshore or, you know, on the beach, and it's the most beautiful sunrise or sunset, right, you know, right, in the world, and you could miss it. because you're not attentive to it. The same thing goes for effort. A lot of the things that don't bring us joy are passive, like scrolling social media. But when we're actively engaged in something, that we can lock in on the things that bring us joy. And that actually, that discovery around attention and effort and needing to notice and nurture those things came out of a conversation I had with the mindfulness expert, Dr. Ellen Langer, because she defines mindfulness as simply actively noticing new things. And so that's kind of unlocked this whole conversation about joy for me.
Yeah, yeah. And so the elements of joy you describe as success and well-being, and of course that can be interpreted in many different ways by many different people depending on their outlook and philosophy on life. How do you define success?
Simply as the achievement of goals, whatever they are, for yourself. And that's, you know, kind of an accepted view of what success means. And that means that we each need to define that for ourselves, right? Identifying goals for ourselves and then moving the needle, right? Moving the ball forward on those things that we want to accomplish in our life.
Right. And what about well-being?
I define well-being as having a positive relationship with your abilities and with your limits. So, you know, in the context of the digital space, there are some people who have an unbelievable ability, an unbelievable capacity for managing so many online relationships. I am someone that lacks that ability. I do not have the ability to manage lots and lots and lots of online relationships. So abilities and limits, really recognizing what they are and living, you know, within those constraints, but in a positive way.
Yeah, it's all about really knowing yourself, isn't it? And understanding where your hot buttons are and stresses are and all that stuff. Because I, too, work with and have friends who I would say live online. They rarely go out. They are happy in their space and most of their relationships are online. That doesn't work for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It would seem like a lot of work to me actually to do
right.
It that way. Yeah.
And then to notice that, yeah, in yourself and then to just accept that.
Yeah.
And to structure your life and your work in such a way that supports that reality.
Right. So I want to talk about one of the chapters in the book, the good burden of being committed. I recently talked with two leadership experts who focus on mindful business relationships and self-leadership. And one of the things I learned from their work is that goldfish now have a longer attention span than we humans. Goldfish can actually focus on one thing for 9 seconds at a time. We humans, 8 seconds. It's shocking, but
wow.
And I know in the book it's just shocking. Yeah. So you talk about commitment to reduce procrastination in this chapter. You know, I know that's a very empowering practice. So share why you think commitment is a good burden for us to have.
Mm-hmm. So the thing that's amazing about commitment is they allow us, especially social commitment, so committing to something, to doing something with another person, is they empower us to do the things that we say we want to do. I think in that chapter, I probably refer to the work of James Williams. He wrote probably the best book on the attention economy in the last 10 years. And he asked the question, what do you pay when you pay attention? And so really being attentive to those things. I think that being committed is a way into doing the things we say we want to do. So for example, I have a social commitment every Wednesday to go for a walk with a group of moms in the neighborhood. I am more likely to go on that walk because I know that two of my friends are going to be there and they're going to want me to be there with them. And
right,
even
right.
if it is truly miserable and so, so cold because I'm in Toronto and it is February, I will go on that walk because when I made that commitment, I knew that getting together socially was really good for my mental and emotional well-being, and also was really good for my body, right, to get out and get moving and also get out of, you know, my house. So commitments are a really important path to living the lives that we say we want to live.
Definitely. And I remember many, what's probably 20 plus years ago when I first moved up to the Pacific Northwest from California. And I met with Barbara Scher, who did a lot of work at the time about commitment. And she was a writer and author, and she used to speak a lot on PBS. And the whole thing there is, you know, if you want to write that book, you know, hire an editor and set up that meeting. Or, you know, if you're going the traditional route, make sure you have those meetings in place. And so it doesn't matter whether it's personal or work, those commitments make the difference between success or not, oftentimes.
And then related to good burdens, because you asked, you know, are they a good burden?
Yeah.
Absolutely, right? Because you're putting effort and attention into those things, and you've decided in advance that they're important to you, and so those social commitments help you see them through.
Right, right. So I want to talk about joy. You know, and I've talked with many people over the years in various groups and organizations and heard, I don't know how to find my joy. I don't have that problem, and I know you don't either, because you had a list of like over 100 ways to find joy. Share some tips on that for people who are in that state. You know, people have been through a lot, especially the past couple of years. There are a lot of people feeling joyless and hopeless, but how do they find their joy again?
I think it starts with identifying one thing and being confident in that choice, being secure in the fact that it's your joy and not someone else's joy, and you don't need to be ashamed or think it's weird that you like that thing. You can celebrate it. If you're really, really struggling with identifying anything, maybe just start with the color palette. Identify a color, right? That's a really contained decision-making, you know, group there. Just choose a color that speaks most to you. And start looking for things that are, in my case right now, I'm really into yellow. Everything yellow. It used to be turquoise, now it's really yellow. And as you identify one joy and start embracing that and bringing those elements into your life, the easier it is to see them and to incorporate them and have confidence in what they are.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned color, because I worked with a coach a few years back, and she would have this expression, put your pink on.
So pink
comes in a whole wide range of colors, of course, as does yellow. But there was a particular pink scarf that I had that I loved, and my sister had given it to me. So when I was having one of those days, I'd put my pink on.
That's amazing. I love that.
Yeah.
And what did it do?
It just
do for your mood and your,
yeah. So I felt nurtured, because my sister had, you know, handpicked this for me, and she knew that I'd love it. Which, of course, you talk about in your book, the importance of nurturing, and it just uplifted me. I felt more positive and just more joyful.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. So we've talked a lot about the power of daily gratitude on the show, and how neuroscience shows the positive changes in the brain when we are grateful, when we are showing gratitude. You also talk about being brave. What does being brave mean to you?
So yeah, kind of related to that, it's kind of just, I write about honing courage and surrounding yourself with people and also voices online that give you courage to do the next right thing in your life. And bravery comes from a confidence in who you are. And a lot of us feel a huge amount of insecurity because of the comparison that the internet breeds, right? Mm-hmm. All of the things that people have or appear to have, and then, you know, lining ourselves up beside it and, you know, not feeling good enough. And we know that comparison is the thief of joy. And so bravery, in a previous interview, someone asked me, you know, how did you have the courage to write this book, especially, you know, given the fact that you wrote it during the pandemic? And the way I was able to answer that was that I have enough people in my life saying to me, keep going. You know, this has value. I love you, right? That right. It gave me the courage to keep going. And I don't know if it's true for you. I can imagine for you and for your for your listeners, that there are crucial times in your life where the perfect encouragement comes in the perfect moment, you know, when you're so down and you're really, really, really ready to give up, that sometimes kind of like miraculously just one person will spark courage in you to keep going. And I know that's definitely been the case in my life.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, last week I hit a wall on a certain situation, and I was like, enough. And I was tired. I wasn't feeling well because I'd had these asthmatic allergies, which are kind of flu-like. And I was sitting at my desk and I just thought, enough. And then my phone beeped. And normally I have it turned off. In fact, I haven't even looked at it today yet. But normally it's turned off, but I had it on my desk and I glanced at it. And my sister had sent me a really, really, really rude joke through. And it just...
That's not what I was expecting.
It cracked me up and it took me totally to a whole different space. So that, yeah, that one person can make all the difference there.
Yeah. And that's what, I mean, you read the book, you know that warm relationships, right? That comes out of the Harvard Grant study. Warm relationships are the key indicator of health and happiness and also outward markers of success. And so we develop a lot of surface level relationships digitally, but you can only, you know, create and sustain so many warm, deep relationships. And they define warm relationships as simply maintaining relationship with a couple of close people in your life, friends or family. That's simply it. And so it makes sense to me that that was a source of joy for you, the fact that it came through your sister.
Yeah. And there's a quote or two I liked around this. And, you know, when we're doing that comparison shopping on Instagram, you know, look at my life versus their life, which, of course, is, you know, those photos are done with intention to make it look as though everybody's having a fabulous life. But there's a saying in your book, you are not behind, you are becoming. And I, for some reason, that really resonated with me. I really loved it. What does that mean to you?
Yeah, and that seems to have come up a bunch of times. So interesting. I was sharing at that point in the book about my own journey, the way that I made peace with not believing that I needed to keep up with the Joneses, you know?
Wow.
We often think that the people that we see online or even just people we know are ahead of us, right? They've got their side hustle going. They've got their... you know, proverbial shit in order,
right,
the relationship
right.
Sorted out, yada, yada, yada. And I started thinking about the fact that that probably wasn't true. And in fact, that came through discoveries and actual conversations with people and realizing that they did not have it together either, just like me. And realizing that I'm not behind, you know, none of us are behind. There's no, you know, roadmap for life, for careers. We all have to carve our own path. And so, becoming.
Yeah. And I also loved the quote, algorithms measure the known, not the possible. Because I know from the adverts that pop up on my feed that, you know, algorithms really don't know me at all. So one of the things I wanted to talk about is unplugging, because I know you're not somebody who, you know, touts digital detox. It's about working with it. I am one of those people who I do try every week to unplug for 24 hours, usually on a Saturday. And I need that. I work on the computer all the time, so I really feel I need it. And it's important to me. And now friends and, you know, family know that I'm not going to be answering any texts or emails on Saturday unless it's an emergency. So how do you tell people to come to terms with that? And you've got many ways in your book, but give me maybe the top two ways that you find really resonate with people without that total detoxing, how they can come to terms with approaching the way they feel about technology differently.
I mean, I will say that I am a big proponent of doing exactly what you described, you know, unplugging fully one day a week. And for me, it's Sundays. That just seems to be an easier day for our family. And we all do it. And it's a practice that I hope that my kids sustain, you know, well into their adult lives. But really practically working with the technology, you know, the three big pushes of technology, the three big promises, and I will go as far to say the false promises of technology are that it's going to give us ultimate convenience, total comfort, and control. But the reality is the things that actually bring us joy are often inconvenient. They probably involve a bit of discomfort, and we can't really control them at all. And so the way to shift things in your use of technology is to use it in three particular ways. This is actually out of a direct study that found that people that are happy with technology use it differently, and they use it for community, creativity, and care. So a really simple way to start using your technology more mindfully, living more joyfully in the digital age, is when you're online, whether you're scrolling, you know, passively consuming, or you're there for work, ask yourself, am I using this to create community? Am I using this to care in some way, either for myself or for someone else or for myself? And am I contributing creatively into this space? And just shifting into those ways of being in the digital space really can turn things around. The second thing I will say is a practice. It is an age-old contemplative practice called the Examen, and it is a simplified version of it that I teach just about everywhere I can, is asking yourself at the end of each day, what today was most life-giving and what today was most life-taking? And just write those two questions down on a piece of paper, you know, draw a line down the middle, put it on your bedside table, and just answer that question, those two questions for a few days, and hopefully maybe you want to continue well past that. What we're going to start to know is where the life-taking and life-giving things begin to emerge, and then you're going to subconsciously want to keep doing the things that bring joy.
I love that, life-giving, life-taking. I must admit, I do try in interactions to acknowledge how I feel when I come away. You know, do I feel uplifted or positive, or do I feel drained and I want to go hide in a corner? Not quite that bad, but you get the picture, right?
Yeah.
So is it life affirming or draining, basically? So yeah, I love that. So how do you integrate this into business, right? Because I'll be honest, a few years ago, I got super burned out. I was working 80 hours a week. I'm, you know, a writer, producer. I'm on the computer all the time. There's no way I can avoid it. I do my research outdoors in nature. I do my brainstorming outdoors. I have a massive sketchbook. I take it everywhere with me. I do that outdoors. Apart from that, I have to be on the computer. So how have you integrated some of these practices into your work life to help it be less of a stressful situation?
Probably the most effective thing that I do is I delay checking email as late as possible every day and kind of work on my three big buckets on terms of professional projects. At the beginning of the day when I'm most fresh, that's the time that I'm, you know, most engaged. I'm more of a morning person. The other thing is, and I actually teach a program called the Jomo Method, and each month we gather together for something I call a digital house cleaning party, and we go into our email accounts, we go into our social profiles, we go on our phones and on our desktops, and we actually clean it out. We delete apps, we delete files, we unsubscribe from content to clear up our digital spaces so that when we go to do the things that we want to do with those digital tools, it's as easy as possible to get to them without getting distracted.
Yeah, something I really need to do, I'm telling you. And something like 1,700 unread emails yesterday, so.
Wow.
So, and these are mostly business that, you know, that it's not spam. So it's a challenge when you work with big corporations sometimes to keep that to a minimum. So how did you apply the principles you talk about in Good Burdens to writing this book? I know you had a lot of support. You had people egging you on. But beyond that, Christina, how did you apply some of the principles you talk about?
I wrote a lot of the book outside, and I guess the way that plays into the principles in the book, so each of the chapters are about a state of being, There are sort of chapter challenges or quests at the end of each chapter, but that aligns with the book in being me and being human, knowing my human limitations and being distracted in my home, you know, being around other digital tools. And so being out of doors, in a park where there's lots of beautiful sounds, like good sounds, from nature and from people walking around and talking, supported me. And I knew that to be true just about myself, that I needed that and loved that. And one of the chapters, like you mentioned before, was, you know, around courage. And there was a statue in that park of a woman that I was deeply inspired by, who's a writer. And she, in her plaque, they have a quote from her that talks about the writer as a source of, you know, betterment in the world and social betterment in the world. And so that little plaque created a lot of encouragement for me. So I guess the overarching idea is that I created the positive conditions
there you go.
For my writing to flourish.
Yeah, very important. And so in closing, there's a section you call The Way Forward, and the start of this decade has been a nightmare for many people. But you say, we have to be honest about what we want. The painful thing I'm about to say is that you can't move toward joy without wanting. The goal is aliveness, the purpose is love. So tell us a little bit more about that and how we move toward joy from here, this point.
Yeah, you were saying earlier, you know, or addressing the fact that many people, right, are having a difficult time connecting to joy because of, you know, the incredibly difficult season we're all coming out of. So yeah, the way into it is identifying for yourself the things that actually bring you alive and starting to surround yourself with those things. Aliveness, I love aliveness, because just like you were saying, after you're with a particular person, just noticing, you know, where those sources of aliveness come from. The reason why we feel, a lot of us feel an incredible amount of dullness and deadness online, because there's mm-hmm. a sameness there, and it's completely passive. Mm-hmm. And so engaging in more active pursuits, as simple as they may be, does instill that aliveness, and I really do think that is the way forward.
Well, Christina Crook, it's been such a pleasure talking with you. I want to leave listeners today with a quest that you share at the end of, you share them at the end of every chapter. This one is toward the end of the book, and that's take up the good burden of being amazed, because I love that. Final thought you'd like to leave listeners with?
I'll leave you with a quote from Paulo Coelho, where he says, "Postpone joy, it will diminish. Postpone a problem, it will grow."
Love it. Christina Crook, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I know listeners can find out much more about Christina and her work at christinacrook.com, and the book again, Good Burdens, How to Live Joyfully in the Digital Age. If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.